Hi, everybody. Welcome to Read Science. I'm Joanne Manister, Science Goddess on Twitter, and I'm here with my co-host, Jeff Schomeyer. And today we are so pleased to have as our guest, Steve Brusati, a paleontologist and author, to talk about his new book today, The Rise and Fall of the Dinosaurs, A New History of a Lost World. Steve, welcome.
Thanks for having me, and hello to everybody listening around the world, including back in Champaign, where you are, where a lot of my family is from. So it's going to be fun to talk about dinosaurs.
Yeah, it's great. So I'm going to go ahead and just read your bio from the back of the book. I assume that's pretty up to date, right? Okay, so this is what the publisher said is important, right?
Exactly. It's the marketing kind of spin on things.
Yeah. So... Steve Brusati is a paleontologist at the University of Edinburgh, a graduate of the University of Chicago. He completed his doctorate at Columbia University. He writes frequently for Scientific American, including the May 2015 cover story on the evolution of tyrannosaurs. His academic research has been published in Science and other leading journals. He has authored a leading paleontology textbook, Dinosaur Paleobiology. He is the resident paleontologist for BBC's Walking with Dinosaurs, and he's a native of the Chicago area living in Scotland. Excellent. We are so glad you are here.
Good. And now with that out of the way, we can talk about dinosaurs.
Yes. I know. So, Jeff, you go ahead and throw out the first question.
Right. Jeff, who is the oldest one here but does not feel like a dinosaur yet, but I was interested way late in the book, after you had talked for a while about previous misconceptions about how Tyrannosaurus rex aged and grew up and how that's been replaced. You said this type of thinking even percolated into the dinosaur books I read as a child, but like many once cherished notions about dinosaurs, it turned out to be false. And that made me think, you know, the books that I read were even older, I think, than the books that you read, with, you know, little golden knowledge things on them. Some of the best ones that were the earliest Time Life books. And we had a good hold on things we were starting to discover. But there are all sorts of things that have changed from the picture we had then of the age of the dinosaurs. Although I think we knew then that people didn't coexist with dinosaurs. And the subtitle of your book is A New History, which I also thought was good. And, you know, when I was starting to read it, I thought, gosh, what could we have learned about these dinosaurs? But there has been so much. And so I'm looking for, you know, an easy way to say, can you lead us into the conversation and get us started on how so much has changed in the last 40 years about what we have come to know about these creatures from 100 million years ago?
Yeah. And, you know, a lot has changed. It's a really exciting time now. This is really the golden age of dinosaur research. People are finding more dinosaurs than ever before. Somebody's finding a new species on average once a week these days. That's nuts, isn't it? That's 50-some new species a year. And that's not a new bone or a new tooth or a new skeleton. That's a totally different type of dinosaur. And so each one of these new discoveries is a clue, and it tells us something new about the history of life. It slots into that story of dinosaur evolution. And all of these new fossils, and also new technologies that we use to study these fossils, like CAT scanning to see inside of the heads of dinosaurs, mm-hmm. to study their brains and intelligence, or computer animation software to study how they moved, how they fed. You put all that together, and we have learned so much over the last 10 to 20 years. Mm-hmm. And so that means that the books I was reading as a kid, it wasn't too long ago, you know, in the late 80s and the 90s when I was in school, those books are largely out of date now. We've just learned so much new. It's given us a new appreciation of dinosaurs. It tells us unequivocally that these were active, energetic, dynamic, intelligent animals. They were well adapted to their world. They were dominant creatures. They formed an empire. They lived for over 150 million years. They were at the top of nature before humans were. They were the ultimate success story of evolution.
There you go. I wrote that down right next to this. Late in the book, You were talking about, you know, the continents were separating. The latest Cretaceous periods saw the greatest diversity of dinosaurs. You said dinosaurs are at the top of their game, doing as well or better than they had ever done, still in control more than 150 million years after their earliest ancestors were born on Pangaea. And, you know, I think I knew that or could have figured that out, but set the stage. I mean, dinosaurs evolved when the Earth looked a lot different, and that explains a lot of things about how there were similarities around the Earth, how there were diversity later, different groups. Talk about Pangaea and its relationship to dinosaurs and geologic ages.
So if we can go back and try to put our minds back in time to about 253 million years ago or so, and this is a world that was totally different than our world. This is the world of the very end of what geologists call the Permian period. So that, you know, geologists have divided up the time scale of Earth history into lots of different periods and eras. So we're at the end of the Permian period, and all of the continents are gathered together as one. It's not like today where there's different continents separated by ocean. You just have one supercontinent, Pangaea, that's surrounded by one global ocean. And that supercontinent is shaped like a giant letter C, an arm of the sea that goes into the sea. The land stretches from the North Pole to the South Pole. So it's the whole depth of the globe. Now, this was not a very pleasant place to call home if you were around back then. In the interior of that supercontinent, you could be 10,000 miles from the closest ocean. And so that meant there were vast deserts in the center of that supercontinent. But also, on the rest of the supercontinent, the weather was really nasty. Because that continent stretched from north to south, that meant during half of the year, as the Earth was rotating around the sun, of course, that during half of the year, the north would be bathed in sunlight and the south would be in wintertime, and then it would switch. And that difference, extreme temperature difference between north and south, led these vast winds to stream across the equator. And this led to monsoons, the same thing we see today when there's sudden changes in wind direction seasonally in places like India, Southeast Asia. But these monsoons were on a global scale, and they were apocalyptic, apparently. That's what the geologists say. They've invented a term for these things, a hyperbolic term. They call them the mega monsoons. And so the mega monsoons helped divide Pangaea into different regions that had different climates, different temperatures, different amounts of precipitation, different types of extreme weather. And so what that meant was that only certain animals could live in certain parts of the world. Even though all the land was connected, it was not really easy to move all around. So that's what the scene was like 253 million years ago. But then things got even worse. Things got really bad because in Siberia, some volcanoes started to erupt. But these were not normal volcanoes. This wasn't Pinatubo, Mount St. Helens, you know, blowing their top. This wasn't the Hawaiian volcanoes that we see today, which trickle out, you know, streams of lava. These were super volcanoes, and they were really super duper volcanoes. And so you had enormous fissures in the Earth's crust that just opened up across much of Siberia and started spewing out rivers of lava for millions of years. And that covered a huge amount of Asia in lava, which hardened into rock. This was a scarred landscape. Anything that lived in that area would have died. But it was a global problem because with that lava came up all these nasty gases from inside the Earth, carbon dioxide, methane, sulfur dioxide, these gases that polluted the atmosphere and led to a runaway greenhouse effect, runaway global warming, one of the worst instances of sudden climate change in the whole history of the planet. And most animals and plants could not cope with that. About 95% of species died out. This was the worst mass extinction that's ever happened in the history of the Earth. It's the closest that life has ever come to going completely extinct.
And this one basically from climate change.
And it was from climate change. It was from those volcanoes spewing out greenhouse gases and those greenhouse gases accumulating in the atmosphere and causing temperature to go up really, really suddenly. So of course, there is a lesson in there. This is why we study these events in Earth history, because they can give us some insight into how our world is changing today. Maybe help us understand our world better and prepare for certain things, mitigate certain things, give us the perspective we need to maybe stop pumping so much of these same noxious gases into the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. But of course, the Earth is resilient, and those volcanoes, they erupted for a few million years, but then they stopped. And as they stopped, the Earth started to heal. Those few survivors were able to come out of their burrows, out of the shadows, and they had a largely empty, open world to colonize. Mm-hmm. And so we're in the next period of geological time now, the Triassic period. You still have the supercontinent. Pangaea is still there. That global ocean is still there. The deserts are still there. The mega monsoons are still there. But now you have a new cast of characters, the survivors, in this largely empty world. And among those survivors were the immediate ancestors of a lot of the most familiar animals in today's world. So the very first turtles, the very first crocodiles, the very first lizards, the very first mammals, some of our very ancient ancestors, and what we call dinosauromorphs.
Yeah.
And this is just the fancy term for the immediate ancestors and cousins of dinosaurs, the little reptiles that dinosaurs would evolve from. And they didn't look anything like a T-Rex. They didn't look anything like a Brontosaurus. They were humble animals. They were only about the size of house cats. They walked around on all fours. They had these stilty long legs. They had gangly looking bodies. They were fast runners. But there weren't that many of them. They were vastly outnumbered by a lot of those relatives of mammals and other types of reptiles.
There's a big evolutionary idea in here, isn't there, that this was a time when a lot of ecological niches suddenly opened up, and evolution has a strong propensity to drive things quickly to fill all the available niches.
That's right. And this was a time of great evolutionary experimentation. You had all these new groups evolving. They all had this largely new frontier, this vacated world to live on. And they were colonizing that world, but also competing with each other. And so that's where dinosaurs came from. They were born onto the supercontinent after the worst mass extinction in Earth history, and they started small, they started humble. Their first fossils are these little wispy footprints that we find in clay quarries in Poland, where they're mining clay to make bricks. And these tiny little prints, just the size of cat's paws, handprints and footprints, those are the first sign of this dynasty that would one day take over the world. But it would still take a long time for the dinosaurs to go from those small little creatures to the big, dominant, ferocious, fantastic, iconic animals that are in Jurassic Park, that are in the museums, the ones that we all know.
Right. And there are a lot of different body plans already showing up then that then spread out and do a lot of interesting things over the course of this 150 or more million years, which is a huge amount of time for something we think of as a thing, the dinosaurs, to go. And I don't know how you can tell people what 150 million years is like. We can compare it to like humans, you know, we've had human culture for maybe 20,000, 10,000 years. Maybe we can identify human-like people from what, 2 million years ago, maybe. 150 million years is a lot longer than that.
You know what? I mean, I don't know how to convey it. I lecture all the time. I teach my courses and run my lab and you know, write these books and all that. But I have not found a good way to even try to start to convey.
There's a different picture there from, I think, the one that was in the books that I had where, you know, on the covers, all types of dinosaurs would be together. That was a long period, and a lot of different types of dinosaurs came and went successively. It wasn't 150 million year stretch of unchanging age of the dinosaurs.
Absolutely. And here's a fact that maybe you've heard it before, and maybe some of you that are listening have heard it before. But if not, I think it'll blow your mind. It still blows your mind. So T-Rex is closer in time to us than it was to Stegosaurus and Brontosaurus. That's crazy. So T-Rex lived 66 million years ago. And Stegosaurus and Brontosaurus lived 150 million years ago. So that maybe can help to start to put into context, to convey these vast depths of time that dinosaurs ruled. And you're absolutely right. They lived for over 150 million years. There were lots of different groups, lots of different shapes and sizes. Some were huge, some were small, some lived in burrows, some climbed trees, some were fast runners. And they ruled the Earth for this enormous period of time, totally an empire, a biological empire. Humans, yeah, I mean, Homo sapiens, 200,000 years or so we've been around. Like you say, culture, I mean, human culture, we can measure that in the tens of thousands of years. Yeah. And so there's no real comparison. And of course, yes, you know, we're sentient and we have our big brains and we're able to build skyscrapers and jet planes. And the dinosaurs weren't able to do that. But really, no matter how great we are or how great we think we are, we have a long way to go before we even start to think about challenging the dinosaurs for their long reign of success.
Right. You know, and I was thinking, so as I was reading the book, there's lots of different ways to present the information about dinosaurs. So you could divide them up by taxon and say, we're going to talk about sauropods and we're going to talk about theropods, right? Or we can look at it as, okay, this is how dinosaurs eat. This is how dinosaurs move. This is how dinosaurs, you know, so by biological characteristics. And then the way that you presented was sort of through geologic time. You know, we found this dinosaur. It may not have been the first dinosaur you found, but you realize it's the oldest dinosaur you found. Right? You know, the Herrerasaurus or whatever, right? So your book is presented sort of, let's talk about dinosaurs in their place in time all the way through. And it was brilliant. It was a great way to present the dinosaurs.
I appreciate that. And I, you know, I think that's the way I wanted to tell the story because the storyline is already there. You know, it's, I don't have to create a novel and create my own storyline. It's the rise and fall, that's the natural story arc, and their humble rise, then their incredibly long period of success, then their sudden fall. And I don't think, you know, that story has ever been told in quite that way before in an adult pop science book, even though it seems kind of so obvious. But there have been some great books on dinosaurs, ones that really inspired me when I was younger. Bob Bakker's book, The Dinosaur Heresies, Jack Horner's books about his adventures discovering the first dinosaur nests and eggs, Mike Novacek's book on the Gobi Desert and the Great American Museum Expedition, Stephen Jay Gould's books of these, you know, very intellectual essays. I loved all those books, but those were a bit different. You know, I also, the sort of books I like to read now, I used to read science books all the time when I was younger, but now I've diversified a bit more. But I really love, I love novels, of course, but I love a lot of books about history, books that give these kind of long stories, you know, things like the rise and fall of the Roman Empire or the Third Reich or those sort of things. And books like Guns, Germs, and Steel and Sapiens and some of the more recent ones.
My favorites.
Books. And, you know, I'm not saying this book is anywhere near those. I mean, those things have sold millions of copies. but I think that style kind of works where you tell a story that takes place over time, and let that natural story go. You know, don't try to overcomplicate it, because I think, like, in Guns, Germs, and Steel, or Sapiens, I mean, this is the story of human evolution and human societies, and it goes from kind of start to today's world. You know, I think with dinosaurs, that story, you can do the same thing. And I just think it's an amazing story. I think it's one of the coolest stories in the whole history of our planet. And that's the inspiration I took in the simplest way possible, is to try to tell a story, the story of the dinosaurs, their biography, and then to try to enliven it a little bit by weaving in some of my own stories, you know, how I came to become a paleontologist, how I first got enthused with dinosaurs, how I was given incredible opportunities by my mentors as an undergrad and as a grad student, and how I got to meet people and travel to different places and work with these amazing colleagues, this great diverse group of people, women and men all over the world, especially in these developing countries like China, Argentina, Brazil, these enormous countries that are opening up, building new museums, new universities, training young students, people of my generation. and weaving in some of those stories to kind of spice up the dinosaur story. So that's what I tried to do with it. And I think ultimately it's one big story. And if you're looking for a dinosaur encyclopedia or a textbook or something like that, that's not what you're going to see here. But hopefully it's something a little bit different, and it can maybe reach a readership of adults that haven't maybe thought much about dinosaurs or even about evolution or science very much since high school, since university. So that's what I was trying to go for, and whether it worked or not, I don't know, but it was a whole lot of fun writing it. And a whole lot of
it's pretty good.
It gave a good picture of how big, how epic the dinosaur story is, that it's a huge thing, a huge expanse of time. There's all these subplots and characters and a pretty visceral feel that, you know, hey, the dinosaur had been around so long that continents were in different places. You know, that's not something that can happen very quickly. That's your fingernail growing right there. So that's been a long, long time. And it shows how the science gets done, which is my segue into another question that I wanted to ask about, since we're talking about, evolutionary ideas and connections and things. And you briefly mentioned this CAT scanning business. And the bigger story you told her was about the, what I wrote down as the Uzbek Tyrannosaurus skull in the Soviet box, which was an interesting enough story anyway. But you had that CAT scanned, and there were two things that I thought was interesting. One, this is a nice example of using modern, much less invasive tools to look at things rather than just sawing the bones open and see what the inside looked like. But I was particularly interested in the second idea, was where you pointed out that the middle ear in this skull was revealed to have a very long cochlea.
Yeah.
And to anyone then, I've read maybe just enough evolutionary things or something. It's like, I thought maybe I would ask you to explain to some people, that's like, how could you find anything interesting in a stupid detail like that? But the story comes out that the stupid detail like that reveals so many things of the way they have to be and how relationships were and how things evolved. Could you explain that a little bit more so that we have that idea expressed?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of fun nowadays because there's a lot of new tools, a lot of new techniques, often borrowed from other disciplines like medicine in the case of CAT scanners, or even movie making animation in terms of some of the software people use to model dinosaurs and how they moved and walked and stuff. And so CAT scanning in particular has really opened up a new dimension into studying dinosaurs, really, literally, because you can find bones and you can look at bones and you can see a lot of information by looking at the bones, but there's so much detail hidden inside of those bones, especially in a skull. I mean, just think of our own head for a minute. How much is in there? Of course, our brain is in there. We have sinuses. That's why I'm coughing a little bit. I have a little bit of a cold. We have all these nerves and blood vessels. If you, you know, cut your face, of course, you're going to bleed a little bit. Our ears are there. You know, you got your earbuds in there. We had our nose, and we got all the tissues that allow us to smell. And, of course, our mouth and everything that allows us to sense taste. And there's just so much there in the head. Now, some of those things will never be preserved in a fossil because you're not normally going to get skin and hair and, you know, the nose and that kind of thing. But there's a whole lot of information inside the skull. The brain cavity, the cavity where the ear is, the sinuses themselves, those empty spaces, all of those things. And so those are hidden if you're just looking from the outside of a fossil. Now, way back when T-Rex was first found in the early 1900s, Henry Fairfield Osborne, the very aristocratic blue blood director of the American Museum of Natural History in New York, who commissioned Barnum Brown, the great collector, to go out and find new dinosaurs, and Brown collected T-Rex, brought it back to New York. Osborne realized how fantastic this animal was, and he wanted to know, how does an animal this big, a hunter, a predator of this size, how did it behave? How did it actually interact with this world? And he knew the brain region and the sense organs, they held the key. But the only thing he could think about doing was sawing open the skull. And he did that. He took the skull of T-Rex and he cut it in two, sacrificed part of the bone. in the name of science because he was so enthused and so intrigued by figuring out what that brain was like. But of course, we can't really do that with most fossils. We're not going to destroy most fossils just to see inside of them. And CAT scanning, that was the solution. Mm-hmm. And, you know, CAT scanners, I don't know when they were first developed. I would imagine they were first developed many, many decades ago, probably by the military. And then, of course, in medicine, they were perfected. But as far as in paleontology, they started becoming used a little bit in the 90s, but it was in the 2000s when it really exploded. And it became a common thing to put dinosaur bones, especially skulls, into CAT scanners and use those x-rays to see inside of the head and then stitch together those x-rays in specialized software packages. And that allows us to build digital models of the brain cavity, of the sinuses.
The key from that is three-dimensional cavities.
Yes.
Spaces inside the brain. And that was an example. And there are so many others that maybe you could elucidate a little bit too. It's like, for, I think when I was younger, people would poo-poo a lot. It's like, oh, so-and-so has discovered a new dinosaur tooth. And now, you know, one would mock and say, and so they've invented an entire dinosaur to go with it. But you make this book whole and all these pieces start to fit together. You see that from the shape of the cavities in the brain, from the, what, encephalopathy quotient, things like that, you can make deductions. From the teeth, you can make deductions. From the way muscles attach to the jaw bones, you can make deductions. From the shape of the pelvis, you can make deductions. From the claws on the toes, and all these things start to fit together. So that's seemed to me like a revealing paleontology in practice, and that there's an awful lot when you have these things and other pictures to draw on. There's a lot you can say about these things now just from a tooth or from these seemingly insignificant details, right?
I mean, Timurlengia, the tyrannosaur from Uzbekistan that you mentioned, is a really good example of that. So that was collected by a couple of colleagues of mine, Sasha Avaranov and Hans-Dieter Seuss. They had a team that went out to Uzbekistan in the mid-2000s and collected a lot of bones. And they collected this back end of a skull, and they could tell it was from a meat-eating dinosaur, but they weren't quite sure. They thought it could be a tyrannosaur, and they asked me for my help, just because I've studied a lot of tyrannosaurs. It's one of the things I studied for my PhD, the anatomy and the evolution of tyrannosaurs. And so they also knew that to really tell what kind of dinosaur it was, we needed to see the brain. We needed to see inside of this thing. And so we have a CAT scanner in my department at the University of Edinburgh. It was actually hand-built by one of my colleagues, Ian Butler, who's a geochemist, but just a real master with building things and tinkering with things and figuring things out, an experimental scientist of the most, you know, respectful degree. And so Ian scanned it. And then I had a student, a great undergrad student, Amy Muir is her name, and she did an undergraduate project using that data, and that then turned into a master's project. And by working together, we could see, yes, the brain inside of that skull, when we CAT scanned it and did the digital modeling, it was a tyrannosaur-style brain. Mm-hmm. So it was a big brain. It had a big sinus right above the brain, a blood sinus. But we don't quite know what it was for. Maybe to cool the brain. It's hard to know for sure. But then it also had this ear with the really long cochlea, and that's a tyrannosaur feature. But this dinosaur was only about the size of a horse. So this was a primitive tyrannosaur. And so it's telling us that tyrannosaurs evolved big brains, high intelligence, a good sense of hearing when they were small, early on. And these are maybe things that helped them rise to the top of the food chain and become really big and become really successful. So they evolved the brains before they evolved the brawn. And then late in their evolution, when you had T-Rexes, they combined the brains and the brawn to become the most amazing, fantastic meat-eating animals that have ever lived on our planet.
So that was a main point about this business of the inner ear, is that this was indeed a tyrannosaur because it shared this evolutionary feature that fits in this particular direction. So it had to be, and that there wasn't just Tyrannosaurus rex, but there's a whole family, a whole lineage, a very long line of those.
Yeah, and I like the point in the book that, okay, so the tyrannosaur fossils haven't been found with feathers, but it seems some precursors to tyrannosaurs have been found with feathers. So we're, you know, paleontologists thinking, we're pretty sure a tyrannosaur had feathers.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep, we are. And, you know, feathers, this is another way the field has changed so much. It was only about 20 years ago that the very first dinosaur fossil with feathers was found. Now we have thousands of them. They mostly come from northeastern China. They're mostly found by farmers, people that know the land intimately, not by scientists. And so this is also an example of how, you know, paleontology isn't just a bunch of posh professors going out and collecting stuff, but, you know, so anybody can find a fossil, and some of the best fossils are found by farmers, by construction workers, even sometimes by hikers, by kids sometimes. But in any case, those fossils were found just a couple decades ago, the first ones, and they tell us now there's many, many species from this part of China. They were buried by a volcanic eruption, almost Pompeii style. So you had entire ecosystems captured in the moment, and these dinosaurs were preserved, going about their everyday business. And that's what locked the feathers in. The feathers didn't have a chance to decay or get eaten by predators. And it tells us that so many of these dinosaurs had feathers. And most of them had simple feathers, feathers that looked like hair. Mm-hmm. You know, feathers, just simple strands. And, you know, not the sort of things that could help these dinosaurs fly, in the same way that our hair doesn't allow us to fly. And Jeff and I, we're balding a little bit, but, you know, Joanne, you have this incredible hair, and you can't fly with your hair. Come on, yeah. Of course, it's silly. But hair evolved in mammals to keep bodies warm, and probably the first feathers in dinosaurs evolved for a similar reason, and probably in the common ancestor of all dinosaurs, somewhere very early in dinosaur history, because we have lots of different meat-eating dinosaurs covered in those simple feathers, and we even have some plant-eating dinosaurs covered in them. And among those dinosaurs that are found with feathers in China are two different species of Tyrannosaur. Mm-hmm. So these were not Tyrannosaurus rex. They were early relatives, basically ancestors of T-Rex. And one was a small one. One was just the size of a dog.
Yeah.
And that is one of the species that tells us that Tyrannosaurs started small and started humble. And they started in the shadows, living with other giant predators. But one of the other ones is a bigger Tyrannosaurus, about 30 feet long or so, called Eutyrannus, and that's covered in feathers too. So that tells us that the Tyrannosaur group had feathers, and the ancestors of T-Rex would have had feathers. And we don't know for sure if T-Rex had feathers, because T-Rex is found in North America. It's found in places like Montana and South Dakota, and there's some fossil discoveries north of the border in Saskatchewan as well. But these fossils are not preserved by volcanoes burying entire ecosystems and capturing everything in a split-second snapshot. But they're skeletons of animals that died and were washed around in rivers, you know, that sort of thing. So not the settings where you normally would get soft bits like feathers or skin preserved. So we don't really have any real direct fossil evidence for what the body outline of T-Rex would have been like, if it had feathers, or what type of feathers it had, if it had scaly skin, if it had a mixture. We don't have any direct evidence of that. But by far, the simplest hypothesis, the simplest conclusion, Occam's razor, the whole thing, is that because the ancestors of Tyrannosaurs had feathers, multiple species, and because all these other dinosaurs have feathers, and where we have those perfect settings where feathers can get preserved, mm-hmm. we see that a bunch of dinosaur species had feathers, even plant eaters. By far, the simplest conclusion is that T-Rex would have had some type of feather too. And so I'm not talking about T-Rex flying around with its tiny little arms. No. But having some sort of very simple hair-like feathers, that maybe it had a lot of them, maybe it didn't have many. It was a big animal, so maybe it reduced its feathers the same way an elephant doesn't have a whole lot of hair. But I'm pretty confident that if we saw a T-Rex alive today, that it would have some type of feather. And I know some people don't like to hear that. And I've heard people say, oh, you ruined my childhood, the picture of T-Rex, the T-Rex from Jurassic Park, and the T-Rex from television documentaries, and from all the kids' books, it was this great reptilian beast, and it was this bloodthirsty monster, and now you've just turned it into a fluffy little birdie.
Right.
Nonsense. To me, birds are terrifying, even though I study them. I don't like being in an enclosed space with the birds, they're flapping around and their feathers are going everywhere. So imagine T-Rex as a 40-foot long, 8-ton bone crunching big bird from hell. To me, that is much more terrifying than a drab green colored scaly crocodilian T-Rex.
Right. And, and the colors of feathers, this is a fairly new finding. The dinosaurs maybe weren't just green. They didn't look like crocodile skin, right?
This, Joanne, to me is the single most incredible thing that we've learned about dinosaurs in my lifetime. I mean, there have been some great discoveries, you know, and I admire my colleagues all over the place for finding things and discovering new things. And that's why I tell a lot of their stories in the book. I'm just in awe of a lot of the things that people have done. And nothing has awed me more than about a decade ago, a guy my age who was a grad student at the same time I was, he figured out how to tell the colors of dinosaurs. Jakob Winther is his name. He comes from Denmark. He doesn't even study dinosaurs. He does now a little bit, but he was doing his PhD on some of the oldest animals. And so he was really interested in figuring out how animals first evolved and how the major modern groups, you know, arthropods and mollusks and those kind of creatures, when and how they evolved and started diversifying. But he became interested in how those first animal fossils were preserved. And that got him looking at a lot of fossils under microscopes, really high-powered microscopes. And he noticed that some fossils seemed to preserve some kind of pigment type of structures. And then he started looking at fossil feathers. And he saw that in well-preserved fossil feathers of dinosaurs, you could see the pigment vessels, the little bubbles that house the pigment. They're called melanosomes. And different sizes and shapes of melanosomes impart different colors. And we know this from modern animals. We can go study birds today and look at and see which colors match up to which melanosomes. And that's what Jakob and a lot of his colleagues have done. And so they figured out that dinosaurs, the ones they've been able to study, have a whole fantastic array of flamboyant and gaudy types of feathers and different colors. There were black ones and brown ones and white ones. There were iridescent ones that had shiny sheens like crows do today. There were ones that had mottled colors all over their body, ones that had camouflage, had counter shading, where they're darker on top and lighter on the bottom. Some were ginger. Some even had tails with rings of white and red, kind of like a raccoon. And these are just the handful of ones that have been studied so far. And so we're working on some new projects now where I'm very privileged to work with Jakob and some of his students. He has a great lab of students in Bristol where he teaches. And it's just amazing to hand over these specimens to them and watch them bring these dinosaurs to life. It is mind-boggling. I remember the books when I was a kid. They would say things like, you know, we'll never know a color dinosaur. Yeah. Maybe they were green. Maybe they were brown. Maybe they were purple. Maybe they were polka dotted. You know, let your imaginations run wild. And yes, let your imaginations run wild, but we now know the colors. Still blows my mind that Jakob was able to figure it out. Yeah. And it does look like that dinosaurs, you know, think of them as birds. Think of all of these different colors that birds have today, that birds use to camouflage themselves, that birds use to attract mates, to intimidate rivals. And I would be willing to bet that dinosaurs had a whole bunch of different fabulous colors and patterns and textures, just like birds.
And this is how you get a cell biologist like me to go, wow, you can use cell biology to study dinosaurs and, you know, to pique my interest. It's, you know, that when it was announced several years ago, I guess you said a decade, I was like, what? It's pretty amazing.
It is. And it's one of those things that shows that when you have a lot of people working on some kind of scientific issue, in this case, dinosaurs, you have a lot of young people, people with new ideas, fresh perspective, people from other disciplines, people that have studied other types of fossils, people that have expertise in other techniques like Jakob did with microscopy, people from a diversity of backgrounds. Jakob was just this Danish guy who was enthralled with fossils and you know, found a way to go to the US and become a grad student there. You put all that together and that sort of diversity and that sort of youth and that sort of excitement and the global nature of paleontology, this is what's driving all of these advances in the field. And the field is much more diverse than it ever used to be. It's much more open to people than it ever used to be. Yes, of course, there's still barriers to some people. And yes, of course, it's still dominated, like most sciences, by white guys at the top and the professor levels, but it's really changing. And if you go to our professional meetings now, just a huge percentage of the young people there are women. A huge percentage are international people. My lab in Edinburgh, I have 8 PhD students, 7 are female. That's incredible. You never would have had that, I don't think, a decade or so ago. And that's not me, you know, trying to be PC or something silly like that. That's because they're the best applicants. When I'm judging, I get 30 applications for each PhD. I got people from around the world that all want to study dinosaurs. And so, you know, this is the way the field's going. And it has me so excited for the future, because anytime a field opens up and it's as diverse and as accessible as possible, that's when you have the best chance for all these different brains and all these different people, all these different perspectives, to learn new things. And that's where the new insights are going to come from. And I'm just excited to see where we are 10 years from now, 20 years from now. It's going to be incredible. This book hopefully won't be out of date too soon.
You know, your book, this is the thing I've been telling people about this book. You captured this diversity of scientists, the diversity of personalities of scientists, and showing the scientists as real people. This is the thing, the best thing you have done for science by writing this book, is to show that scientists are people. And I actually have a funny little part here where you were describing Ricardo Martinez.
Yes, and friend, yes.
Yeah, and you said he kind of looked like the dude from The Big Lebowski, wild, tangled hair, beard thick around the mouth. Interesting fashion sense. And there are so many unusual characters and then just regular people, but every single person, you found a way to describe them in such a way that they were relatable. They weren't these ivory tower scientists. They are out there doing things. They have a personality and they all have something to contribute. And you show the collaborative nature of science. You show that these are real people. And, you know, I'm really grateful to you for doing that in your book.
Thank you for saying that. And I tried to do that, and I wanted to convey that. I wanted to show the great diversity of people studying dinosaurs now. I wanted to get across that excitement of this new generation. It was a little bit difficult to try to slot it all in, because I wanted the dinosaurs to be the main story. I mean, some of these people, like Ricardo's one example, Jingmei O'Connor, who's a colleague of mine who's based in China. She's the world expert on fossil birds. I describe her later in the book. I mean, if you met Jingmei, you would never guess she's a scientist. She's covered in tattoos and piercings. She DJs in her spare time. She has this wicked sense of humor. I mean, if you met her in the club, which is where you might meet her, I mean, you would never know that this young woman, 34, 35 years old or something, is the world expert on how birds evolved. And so I wanted to try to make these people relatable and introduce some interesting people, but not to overwhelm it so much that it just became a book of human characters and a book of gossip or anything, you know. So I hope I struck the right tone there, and I'm sure some people like it, and some people might think it's a little too chatty or it has too many people in it, or maybe some people might think, oh, you need more, you know, one type of person in there. Maybe, you know, you need more representation of certain groups. But I really did my best to try to convey what I think is this just amazing diversity of really cool, really relatable people, regular old people that are driving this field.
Well, the characters are certainly interesting, and they were interesting because they were characters, but they're interesting not just because they're characters, but they're doing interesting work. And so Joanne admires that aspect. And I think the aspect I admired that we're always looking for because of the nature of what we talk about is the way these discoveries and people and the way they go about finding questions and finding answers gives us a lot of insight that's not too hard to swallow about how science goes about doing its work. And, you know, to answer all those, the naysayers who say, well, how do you know what dinosaurs were like? You weren't there. And the other ones, I particularly enjoyed, you know, once you have feathers, can sexual selection of wings be far away as a possible way of evolution, a good story of evolution using whatever's available in a particular body plan and natural selection just doing its thing and that wings did not arise suddenly because evolution decided it was time for an airfoil.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, what's amazing to me, so, you know, I do have a lot of these factoids in the book, right? Able to say things like wings did not evolve for flight, or, you know, this dinosaur was this color, it was iridescent, or this dinosaur had a great sense of smell. And, you know, a few people have gotten in touch with me and said, you know, come on, you're speculating, this isn't serious science. And I respond and say, well, wait a minute, you know, read the book carefully, like, yes, there's a little bit of license, and I open some of the chapters with kind of hypothetical scenes, but the meat of the book, this is stuff that we know. This is stuff that there's evidence for it. Of course, we can't see these dinosaurs alive. There's going to be plenty of things that we won't be so confident about. But we have learned so much about dinosaurs from real fossils that we can do things like tell the color of them, tell what kind of senses and intelligence they had. And that means, believe it or not, I mean, we know more about a lot of dinosaurs, particularly ones like T-Rex, than we do about a lot of modern day animals. There are more people studying T-Rex than a lot of modern day species. And so we know more about how it moved and how it fed, what it ate, how it grew, all those things than we do about, actually, I would probably say the vast majority of living species. And this is all because there's so many fossils and there's so many new technologies and there's so many people interested. And you know, the wing thing that you mentioned is a good example of that. I mean, you know, I think people used to think, well, feathers evolved for flight. Birds use their feathers to fly. So feathers evolved for flight. Well, then when those first feathered dinosaurs were found, we were able to see, well, no, the first feathers are these very simple hair-like structures. They're just coating the body. These animals couldn't fly, so they must have evolved for something else. And then later, they became co-opted for flight. And then people started to say, okay, well, we agree with that, but wings must have evolved for flight. Wings are an airfoil. Of course, birds use their wings to fly. But now when we see the first wings are showing up in dinosaurs like some of these raptor dinosaurs or like these ornithomimid dinosaurs, these oxford mimic dinosaurs that Darla Zelenitsky, my colleague in Calgary, that she discovered in Canada a few years ago, these big dinosaurs that are horse-sized that have these piddly little wings, those are the first wings. So the first wings couldn't even be used to fly. No chance. So we think they were probably used for, well, they probably evolved for one of the many other things that birds use their wings for. We have to remember, birds use feathers and wings today, not just to fly, but to keep warm, to protect their eggs, to display, to intimidate rivals, to attract mates, and many, many, many other features. Some birds even use their wings to swim, you know. So we think that probably wings evolved, at least one of the leading ideas. We don't know it for sure, but it's the idea I think has the most support right now, that wings first evolved for display as advertising billboards, essentially sticking out of the arms of these dinosaurs that they use to woo mates, that they use to look really scary to their rivals if they were fighting over territory. And the evidence for that comes from the fact that the first wings in the fossil record show up on these dinosaurs that are too big to fly, and that we see so many fantastic colors in these early feathers and wings. Right. And so I think that the best supported idea now, and this of course can change with new fossil discoveries, but I think the best supported idea is that these feathers first evolved to keep these dinosaurs warm, then some dinosaurs, a small number of dinosaurs, modified those feathers and made some of them bigger and lined them up on the arms in order to use them as display structures.
And now, this is real science. This is good science. And I think, you know, the way you tell the story exposes that. And is also another very important point about science and scientific knowledge, which is that it can change.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, very little of this is written in stone, to use an overused cliche in paleontology. I mean, there are certain things we know and we're confident in, but there are still gaps in the story of dinosaurs. You know, there are still gaps. And so we know quite a bit more about the rise of dinosaurs now, much more than we knew a decade ago. If I was having a talk a decade ago, there's no way that I could have ever written something like this. You know, we just wouldn't have known the first part of the story. And of course, we know a lot about the fall of dinosaurs, but there's still parts of that story in between that we're still struggling with. And we just don't have a lot of fossils yet. We're waiting for somebody to find the right fossils. And one good example of that is, you know, why the dinosaurs were able to survive that second big extinction, this Pangaea split up, and the crocodile animals, which were so diverse, they were the ones that were keeping dinosaurs down at that time, why most of them died out, leaving only the modern groups of crocs. You know, we don't know why that is. I wish we knew why. It would make this story, it would make this a lot better. You know, it would make it more complete. And
I appreciate that in the book you would say things. This has literally kept me up at night.
That's the one that's kept me up at night. Because I want to know, what was it about dinosaurs that allowed them to survive that cataclysm? Mm-hmm. And we just don't know. There's not enough good fossils from right around that extinction. At least not yet. But I think
somebody will find some.
And I really do think, and I say that in the book, that this is one of these big mysteries that is going to be solved by the next generation of paleontologists. It's waiting to be solved. It's waiting for the right people to find the right fossils or to come up with some new technique to better understand the dinosaurs that we have, to maybe realize that the dinosaurs had a different biology than the crocs. They were growing differently, or who knows. But I'm pretty sure that we'll see one of the young guns solve this one. Maybe part of the generation that's inspired by the new Jurassic Park movie. You
know? Maybe, and yes, and I wanted to make sure we touch upon the movie dinosaurs. We definitely want to talk about, what are they getting right? What are they getting wrong? I mean, even when we have experts consulting, still the movie maker will say, well, the movie's better this way. let me you expound on that.
Well, I am, maybe I'll surprise you a little bit here, but I'm not going to rip into Jurassic Park. You know, I'm not going to be one of those people, you know, the comic book guy mentality, if you're a Simpsons fan, of, you know, critiquing every little thing, and worst dinosaur ever and all that. I'm not going to do that. I could, of course. I mean, I could take you scene by scene and kind of tell you what I think of each dinosaur and how realistic it is and if they've made mistakes. But to me, that's just totally unnecessary. And that's stupid, because I love Jurassic Park. The original movie was great. I was 9 years old when I saw it in the cinema with my dad and my brothers. That showed this new image of dinosaurs. It was a revelation to me. It didn't make me immediately want to become a paleontologist, but my youngest brother, Chris, who, you know, lives not far from you, Joanna Champagne, he got obsessed with dinosaurs, and he eventually grew out of it, and now he went into the museum field where he's, you know, working Rantoul. But he made his bedroom into a dinosaur museum. He built a dinosaur library. That's what got me into dinosaurs. It stemmed from that movie. And it's a great movie. It's entertainment. It's not a science documentary. And those dinosaurs, for 1993, they're pretty damn good. They were pretty much in line with what the scientists of the day were saying. And we didn't know at that point that dinosaurs had feathers. The fossils hadn't been found yet. So, of course, they weren't going to put feathers on those dinosaurs. They would have been eviscerated by the critics, and they would have been eviscerated by the dinosaur paleontologists of the day. You know, they would have, but it would have been said, those dinosaurs are not realistic. You're trying to make them something they're not. So to me, I love Jurassic Park. It was the greatest thing that's ever happened to dinosaur paleontology, as far as I'm concerned. It led to such an explosion of interest in dinosaurs. That led to more funding. It led to more museums putting on dinosaur exhibits, more universities putting on dinosaur courses. And it led to jobs. I have colleagues that are kind of a generation older than me that specifically got their jobs because a museum or a university wanted a paleontologist because of Jurassic Park. So I love it, and I'm very excited to see the new film. I haven't seen it yet. It is out here in the UK, so we're planning on seeing it tomorrow. And you know what? I know the dinosaurs are not going to be accurate. I know they're not going to have feathers. I do, yes, wish that they would put some feathers on the dinosaurs, just because for me it's weird to look at a dinosaur and not see feathers. But regardless of that, you know, I know these are going to be sci-fi dinosaurs, hybrid dinosaurs, all of this, but I just want to see a good film, be entertained, and hopefully it's the sort of thing that can help inspire the next generation.
Yeah, so I'll check your Twitter feed to see what you think of the movie before it comes out here in the U.S. So
I was looking through my list of things that I've written down, and there's so many. I was like, choose one more to talk about. And I don't know. I liked where you said T-Rex is a celebrity character, but it's also a real animal, and that we now know quite a lot about it. But I read that, here's a little note, you said that Rex probably had the strongest bite of any land animal that ever lived, 13.5 kilonewtons, of about 3,000 pounds. And maybe if you'll tell that story, that'll give me one more example of like, here's how scientists can actually figure out things using a chain of deductive reasoning that has to be.
And there's two scientists who I really admire that helped put together that story. There's Greg Erickson, who's a professor at Florida State, and there's Emily Rayfield, who's a professor at Bristol. And Emily is one of the people who also taught me in my master's degree. And, you know, she's become a very prominent paleontologist now. She's the next in line to be president of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology. And, you know, and so she's really interesting because she has a bit of an engineering background. She wasn't necessarily trained as an engineer, but she learned a lot of the software, a lot of the techniques when she was a student. So she has brought this computational engineering way of thinking and way of testing hypotheses to paleontology. And Greg is similar. Greg actually did work in engineering departments at universities for a while. And he's brought that a similar sort of background, but also a very experimental background. Mm-hmm. So T-Rex, this was an animal about the size of a bus. It weighed 7 or 8 tons. It had a head the size of a bathtub. It had 50 plus teeth in that head. Each one was the size and shape of a banana. It had huge jaw muscles. You can see from where they attach these enormous depressions on the head.
And when it was a teenager, it put on 1,500 pounds a year, which is
and
amazing.
They grew so fast.
Yeah.
But there's some fossils that show the fossil bones of Triceratops and bones of duckbill dinosaurs that have tooth marks that perfectly match the size and the spacing of T-Rex teeth. And those are really deeply impressed in the bone, really deep. And so Greg Erickson took an interest in those when he was a younger scientist, and he decided to try to do an experiment where he would figure out how much force is needed to make a hole of that size and shape and depth in a bone. So he rigged up a mechanical T-Rex jaw, essentially, and had it bite down into a cow bone, which is kind of similar to Triceratops bones, and calculated how much force it would take. And that showed that it had these enormous bite forces, and it showed that those were probably the largest bite forces, or at least among the largest of any animals that have ever lived, and that they were strong enough to crunch through the bones of their prey. Now, Emily Rayfield came around a little bit later, and she wanted to understand, you know, how do you have a head like that that is capable of producing those kind of bite forces. And so she CAT scanned some skulls, she built some digital models, she used this engineering software called finite element analysis, which is what a lot of engineers use. You know, if you're going to build a bridge, you want to be sure that bridge can withstand the force of traffic going over it. And you want to be sure of that before you start building it. And so you'll build a digital model and you'll use the computer to simulate what the traffic will be like and see how the bridge structure that you've designed reacts to that. You can use the same technique, but with the CAT scan of the Tyrannosaur skull, and you can use the computer to simulate what it would be like if it's biting into a Triceratops. And so Emily studied this, and she saw that the skull was optimally evolved, really, to have fused bones in the right places in order to support such enormous bite forces, kind of like the fuselage of an airplane. This had to be so strong to withstand those forces and still be functional. So that's how that sort of understanding has come about. It's come about through fossils, those fossils with the bite marks. It's come about through experiments that have been rigged up to study those fossils. And it's come about from software, from hardcore computational science, and particularly from methods that have been borrowed from other sciences, like engineering. And so you put all that together, and I think it's a good example of modern style paleontology.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's incredible. You know, we are close to the end of an hour time with you, which has been wonderful because you're so ebullient and excited and passionate about this topic. Is there anything else you would like to mention before we sign off?
Well, I know that my wife is downstairs starting to cook dinner, and I know I'm going to need to help her. So I probably know if I get into another question.
Exactly.
Going to be another 10 minutes of me with my hand gestures and my excited voice and everything. But I guess I'll just close by saying, you know, dinosaurs to me, I think they are the most fantastic creatures that have ever lived. I think they're more fantastic than dragons and unicorns and sea monsters and all these things humans have invented and myths and legends. But dinosaurs were real and they had this long history. They were an empire. And it's a great story. I think it's a great story. Hopefully I've told it well in the book. But it's not only a great story, and they're not only awesome creatures. They are relevant animals. They were animals that lived for a long time. They were really good at what they did. They had to evolve in concert with changing climates and changing environments and drifting continents and volcanoes and all kinds of things. And then ultimately they died out when they were at the top of their game, when the climate and the environment changed so suddenly that the normal rules of evolution were thrown out the window and dinosaurs couldn't cope. So even though they had been on top for 150 million years, they were gone so quickly. Yeah. And so I hope that story gives us some perspective. And it is relevant. We need to study these animals like dinosaurs from the great vast history of our planet to understand how our planet works, what happens when climates change, what happens when environments change. And also, I think we want to, you know, consider that lesson of the dinosaurs. If it could happen to the dinosaurs, if they could go out on top, something like that happened to us. And I don't want to be eerie. I don't want to be pessimistic, but I think, you know, that sort of perspective is an important one to have because we are newcomers to this long, great legacy of evolution.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for joining us, and especially thank you for writing your book. For those of you who are just joining us, it's The Rise and Fall of the Dinosaurs. It's great. You have done a great service to the field of paleontology, dinosaur paleontology, and to science in general, and to scientists. I think it's a marvelous book, and the story is so well told.
Well, and thank you very much. It's great to hear that. I'm really glad you liked it. And thanks for giving me the chance to do what I love to do best, just to talk for an hour about dinosaurs. So,
you're welcome.
Maybe some of the younger crowd out there, you know, think about coming to Edinburgh one day and studying with us.
Very good. Well, everybody, thank you for joining us on Read Science with our guest, Steve Brusati. And we'll see you again next time.
Bye.